The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Jason Freeman, producer and editor here in the library's author events office, and I am so stoked to be here tonight to introduce Jeff Tweedy. Even if you hadn't braved this weather, I imagine most, if not all of you, know tonight's author bio even better than I do, so I'm not going to go through all that. We want as much time with tonight's author as possible. I'll just say that Uncle Tupelo came along and let a nerdy West Virginia kid know that it was okay to like country music. All right, and in the new memoir you're all holding in your hands, titled Let's Go, So We Can Get Back, a memoir of recording and discording with Wilco, etc., tonight's author tells the story of his Midwestern upbringing and current life as a husband and father, the early Chicago indie rock scene that launched his career, and his musical process and perspective. A review in the Chicago Tribune says this book succeeds in entertaining and oddly revealing ways, moving with shape-shifting ease from wry self-effacement to what he calls Midwestern sarcasm to naked confession, metaphorically. Mr. Tweedy will be joined in conversation tonight with Philly's own, we'll claim her now, Talia Schlanger, a native of the Great White North, a former award-winning CBC radio host, and a former professional actress and singer. She is currently the host of World Cafe, produced right here by Philly's own WXPN and distributed by NPR around the whole wide world. So without further ado, let's go so we can get back home out of the cold. Let's warm it up this cold night for Jeff Tweedy and Talia Schlanger.
Thank you very much.
It's Jeff Tweedy. That's a nice warm welcome.
That's very nice. Thank you. And so, you all made it too. It's like it was.
Yeah, we all made it. Are we any worse for the wear? Everybody feeling okay out there?
Do we all live here now?
Yeah, the good news is we're just going to read the book. We're camping out here for the night. Jeff's going to read the whole thing to
Nowhere
us.
Nowhere to go.
Yeah. Until spring, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's like an extended tour. This is a different kind of tour than you have ever done before, I think. Like, you're used to road life, but maybe not book road life.
Book road life is way crazier. My wife and I did zero stuff today. We laid around. Anyway. But that's actually not that different than normal.
But you're traveling on the Rockstar bus for book tour.
It's actually more of a Rockstar bus than general, because it's got like a little apartment in the back of it just for Susie and I. Aww. Which is like Taylor Swift's bus or something. Like, it's not Taylor Swift's bus. It's not that nice, but it is nicer than normal. Anyway. I think it might be fish level. Be a fish level bus.
They actually have that, like, where you rent buses from. Like, they have graded systems and like fish, and then there's the Taylor Swift. And
yeah. Taylor Swift has like a gym, like a exercise pool.
Yeah, suspension water tank and the whole thing and the pods.
Yeah, no, yeah. This just has a big TV.
So we're here to talk about your tour bus, but we're also here to talk about this tremendous book that you've written, that you all have a copy of in your hands right now, right? This is, now, I'm not kidding and I'm not blowing smoke. Like, this is a beautifully written book.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. We read, like, I read a lot of rock memoirs for my job. I'm sure that people here who are music fans read a lot of memoirs or pieces of writing that musicians have read. And oftentimes you're in it for the stories, and you know that no matter, like, well, the writing's not that great, whatever, there's going to be some amazing stories in here. The stories are amazing, but the writing is beautiful, and it's so different than your songwriting. because it, well, first of all, because it's prose, but it just knocked me out. So I just wanted to say congratulations on just a beautifully written book.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I read out loud a lot.
Did you?
When I was writing, yeah.
It's conversational.
To try and make sure that it sounded like me. I figured if I could do that, that was going to be pretty awesome. Not awesome because it sounds like me, but a bit awesome. Awesome, never mind. See, it's hard to put these types of sentences into grammar.
Yeah.
I discovered that because they're not real sentences. I'll start answering questions instead of explaining myself.
No, it's good. So you write about a lot of stuff in this book, and you write a lot about a lot of tough stuff, the ups and downs of a career in rock and roll, and you write about drug addiction and recovery and losing people. But I wanted to start with the most heartbreaking story from the book, just to get this one out of the way. And it's the time that teenage Jeff Tweedy didn't get to see the Ramones play. And Dee Dee Ramone did you wrong. So
just to let Dee Dee off the hook, I don't think Dee Dee intentionally did us wrong. I don't think he had the kind of memory that would be required to remember that he had promised us something 15 minutes earlier.
Okay.
At that moment in his life. So rest in peace.
Well, yeah, we'll forgive it. But it's a very sweet story. You're for people who haven't read the book yet, you go to Mississippi Nights, which is this club in Illinois that you would go to, and you got a ticket to go see the Ramones. And
it's in St. Louis, actually.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the record store in our hometown sold us tickets that were adult tickets, and we weren't old enough to go to the show, and we're like, what do you think's going to happen? And we're like, oh, they'll let you in. And they just wanted to sell the tickets, I guess. So it ended up being a whole bunch of kids that weren't allowed into this Ramones show, and none of us would give up very easily, so we ended up kind of congregating outside of the Ramones tour bus. I could tell the whole story. It is in the book, but it was pretty sad. We did get to meet Dee Dee Ramone. He walked by, and we complained that we weren't allowed in, especially given the fact that so many of their songs were about teenage lobotomies and other teenage things. And he seemed to be on our side. He's like, you're right, that is bullshit. That is bullshit. Well, we're not going to play until we get you in. So we all thought we were going to be escorted in. And then one of the most humiliating moments of my life, it started raining. We're still waiting outside. It's about showtime. The bus door opens. And Joey Ramone starts coming down the steps, and I push my way to the front of the crowd, and I'm like, what's going on, Joey? Are you guys still going to play? And he had no idea what I was talking about, because he and Dee Dee don't talk that much or something. I don't know. And he said, what, because it's raining? No, I forgot my galoshes. That was it. That's the whole story.
Thank you for that. I love that heartbreaking story.
It was one of those camera effects where the person gets further away. That was like me like shrinking to the back of the crowd. Punk rock shows were pretty confusing for us to begin with because we didn't know where people got all those jackets and boots, all the clothes that they were all wearing. Coming from Belleville, it was really confusing.
It's a big barrier to entry, yeah.
Yeah, like, where do they get these clothes?
Where are you shopping? That would have been a good question.
We didn't have shops like that in Belleville.
So it's quite amazing how much you reveal in this book and how many stories you relay. But what I found really surprising, and I haven't encountered in a memoir before, is that at certain parts, you actually disclose the conversations that you have with loved ones about how much you should be revealing in this book, and it's this. There are these like little meta moments that you've put in there where you're talking to your wife Susie about how much of your recovery from opiate addiction you can put in there, and talking with your son Spencer about how much of your relationship together he really wants you to reveal in the book, and you've written them out sort of like the dialogue that you're having, like it's like a play.
Yeah, and they actually read their parts in the audio book too, by the way.
Do they really?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, it sounds a little bit like a high school play. It does, because they aren't the original recordings of the conversations. It's just it's a little tenuous.
They're like acting themselves. That's very funny. So, but did you actually write down? Like, were you recording these conversations that you were having with them and then transcribing them for the purpose?
They
of
They were
book?
Transcribed. Yeah.
Wow.
So Susie debates that.
Really?
She thinks she thinks the whole book is a lie.
Uh-oh. She's here.
She's here. We're not going to point her out, okay. But she's not going to read the book, so don't tell her what it's about. I don't think she has. Have you read the book? No.
No.
Parts. She's dabbled enough to know that she doesn't want to read the book.
Okay.
I think. Okay. I'll read it to you tonight, honey.
Okay, well.
I'm sorry.
Oh, well.
No, it's not that kind of book. It's not. Never mind. We need to move on before.
Yeah, here we go.
Before I end up making the rest of this trip by myself.
Yeah, you're gonna have it's gonna be a big ride in that Taylor Swift bus.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a big, big bed.
No, but let's talk about the conversation that you have with your son Spencer in the book that you sort of work out together. I guess you're grappling with how you want to represent yourself as a dad, in having him and then raising him and playing with him as a musician now. And he, you don't see eye to eye in the beginning, I guess, about how you ought to be writing about yourself. And I just thought it was a really interesting thing to put out there. So can you talk us a little bit through figuring out with your son how much of your own story you'd want to tell and how you'd want to tell it?
Well, the reason that I basically interviewed my family members about what I wanted to put in the book is because from my perspective, I've had enough terrible things said about me in my life that there really wasn't much that I felt like I wanted to protect and make into an idealized version of myself. But to do that, to write honestly about myself, I had to kind of check in with them and see how okay they were with me talking about the things that I feel like I've failed at, like as a husband and as a father. I just don't also didn't really trust myself to I don't know. I really wanted to know how they look at me and what they were comfortable with sharing, because our relationships and our family are really important to us, and it really, I didn't want them to feel like it was misrepresented, I don't know, smoothed over or fictionalized or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, even doing the interview part, it's still not the whole truth, so it still feels a little bit like reduced to something on the page.
Yeah, but there's a lot of nuance in it, and there's a lot, like you let us in on your son's thought process about who and what you are.
Well, Spencer's extremely thoughtful. Both Sammy and Spencer are really painfully thoughtful kids. I think they're burdened by being very thoughtful. Perhaps in a familial way, Spencer's conversation kind of blows my mind when I look back at it, because he's in real time reevaluating how he thought about me when he was younger, and whether he has changed or I have changed as he's gotten older, and the answer is obviously both. But it was like it's just kind of blowing his mind that as he gets older, he sees me more clearly, but also can't completely trust that he's not just getting he's not just changing too.
Yeah.
So anyway,
it's deep, you guys. Book,
he does a better job of it than I do, I have to say.
Everybody should go read the whole book, but that passage, like, that's deep. And it's very clear in what you're saying now and in the way that you've written the rest of the book that you care a lot about people who are in your life, whether they're in your family or whether they're in your musical family. And you write really lovingly about your friend Jay Farrar, who you founded Uncle Tupelo with. Mm. And I think people or fans might have heard some of the more juicy details about what happened when that band was no longer and might be fixated on that part of the story. But one of the delights of reading this book is that, like, you really seem to relish in remembering wonderful times that you guys had together. Is there a favorite thing that you were able to share with your fans about your relationship with Jay through writing this book?
I don't know if I can think of a specific thing that I felt great about being able to share. I felt great about being able to answer questions that no one ever asked me, which is like things like, tell me how much fun you and Jay used to have. Mm-hmm. You know, that just doesn't fit the narrative of anything that's happened since Uncle Tupelo ended. But Jay and I met in high school, and it was, I think, you know, miraculous to meet somebody that cared about the same music in a small town like that at that time. It changed my life, and it's really hard not to be, I heard somebody describe it as being generous or something, you know, because I'm not really dwelling upon having an axe to grind or settling a score or something like that. But it's easy to feel that way about Jay. He was a, you know, really important person to me, and, you know, he always will be, you know, because we, you know, changed each other's lives, I think.
Yeah, it's really clear in the book. And I was wondering as I was reading those parts, if you give your editor a really nice shout out at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if the editor has to call or contact people who are mentioned in the book who might have an opinion about how things went down. Like, is that a part of the process?
They do go through some editing processes where they fact check and they send it to a legal department to see if the kid who used to supply drugs to me, if we can mention the name of his pharmacy.
Which you did not, so the answer must have been no.
You may not. It's Walgreens, but anyway. I really didn't think they're going to come after me.
I think you're probably fine.
But no, none of the. It's not a history book. I mean, it's my memoir. It's my memory, my story. So what's one of the things you have to figure out when you're writing a memoir is, you know, how vast the truth is, and you have to find, you have to compromise. You have to find somewhere that feels emotionally truthful and still tells a story clearly. Mm. That's the part that I felt like I had to figure out.
Yeah, the details that you recount are, like, incredible and from a long time ago. You must have some memory on you.
I don't have a good memory at all. I have a terrible memory, but it's weird. When you are writing and you get really deep inside the process of, you know, kind of seeing the story and wanting it to appear on the page, I've discovered that writing is connected to memory somehow. I've had tons of things come back to me that I haven't thought about in 30 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Where you're, like, remembering something as you're writing it down, but you,
yeah,
know that,
absolutely,
you remembered
it. And yeah, it was a little distracting because I those are the kinds of things that I would put into songs or poems.
Hmm.
Little details that are, I really enjoy making vivid somehow without a greater context. So I had to really focus my mind on telling a story clearly and ignoring some of those details. You know, like, actually, whatever's in there is the bare minimum of what I thought I could get away with.
To tell the story and have it be emotionally true for you.
I thought so, yeah. I don't know. You know, you could like you could talk about any moment forever. You could talk about like I don't know how warm it was in the room or things that don't advance the story, don't tell much else about like. But those are the things I'm generally drawn to. So it was almost the opposite of my normal writing.
Yeah. Well, in the book you write about how songwriting for you often starts with the music, and that the emotional truth is contained in the sounds that are being made and the melodies and the way that they're being carried, and that the words flow out of that. And maybe the words, like you talk about like sort of mumble writing, even where the words don't have to be true at all, but they'll carry the emotional truth of the music that you're making. So that's like complete opposite of sitting down and starting with words.
Yeah, I think that the landscape or the musical environment and the melody of any song, I personally, and I know other people who feel differently, but I personally think that the melody is doing most of the emotional heavy lifting, and that's why words and lyrics look so kind of, they struggle on the page by themselves a lot of times, but they sound profound in a song. So I've always, what I've figured out how to do to, I don't know, I think I started doing this so I wouldn't attach stupid lyrics to a song and ruin it before it ever had a chance. But I figured out how to kind of sing what sounds like words. And in fact, I'll play it for people and they'll think I have a finished set of lyrics, but it's just, it's gibberish. It's not singing actual words, but it's the sounds of words. And I'll work, that's so I can work on it for a long time before I have to commit to what, I can still kind of be listening to it and thinking, what is the song about? And what ends up happening inevitably is our brains are really wired to notice patterns or identify patterns, like looking at clouds and seeing animals and things like that. I eventually start hearing real words. And so then I'll write those down and start from there. And over time, it'll be like, oh, I guess this song is about my mom. Or, you know, like, oh, something will start to appear. And it's kind of like carving a big block of wood into a woodchuck or something. No, it's just kind of like it just starts to appear, which I it's a process I really enjoy. And it saved me a lot of, I feel like I have a lot fewer turds in the punch bowl at the end of the day when it comes to, you know, like lyrics that just like, they totally break the spell. I don't want to have that in there, but unfortunately I have to sing it for the rest of my life.
Yeah. No turds in the punch bowl. Good takeaway.
That's the next book.
Yeah. You do a really lovely job of tracing where your love of sounds comes from in the book, and a phrase that sticks out to me that I've started thinking about while I'm listening to other sounds just in the world is music is anything, and lots of people say that, but I really think that you believe it. You talk about your dad's train recordings when you were a kid and like being in love with this album of just like train sounds and hearing music in that. And Cold War era radio transmissions and space sounds and all that. So can you take us back a little bit to cultivating your love of sound and hearing music in just about anything?
Yeah, my dad had this really, we didn't have a whole lot of records in my house growing up that belonged to my parents. I inherited some records from my older siblings, but my dad had this record called Sounds of Steam, which was all recordings of train engines.
It sounds like a metal album. I'm sorry. Yeah. Sounds of Steam.
It's trains. Pretty intense. And I've never figured out where it came from or why he had it. He worked on the railroad his whole life. There's no way he wanted to listen to that when he came home from work. Excuse me. So somebody must have given it to him at some point. It was a Folkways record. It wasn't even an easy-to-find record. They're still hard to find. But my dad had a Johnny Cash record, and this isn't really in the book, but Johnny Cash sang about trains. He said, you know, Folsom Prison Blues. Mm-hmm. So I would always put on the Sounds of Steam record thinking it was going to be Johnny Cash because that had a picture of a train on the cover, like before I could read and everything. Oh. So that record was listened to probably more than any other record because I couldn't figure out which one was the one about the trains. So Johnny Cash and actual steam locomotives were my two first influences.
But then somehow you figure out how to take that. Like, it really, I think it really happens between Wilco's first record, between AM and Being There, where we hear soundscape like become a really big part of your creative expression. Can you speak a little bit to figuring out how to make that happen? Am I hearing that right? Like, is that fair to say?
Well, Uncle Tupelo made four records, and two of them are primarily live recordings, mm-hmm. in the studio. And the other two, the first one is like an 8-track recording with hardly any overdubs. And the second one is one where we tried to use the studio the way we pictured bands using the studio. And it was the most disillusioning experience.
How did you picture that bands use studios?
Oh, you know, like using overdubs, actually. Okay. We were pretty austere about the way we approached recording. We thought you were supposed to do it like the way the Minutemen did it and like play live in the studio. We were suspicious of anything other than a documentarian style of recording. And it was a puritanical approach. And I thought that I was a part of that that philosophy because I was a part of Uncle Tupelo. And so AM is primarily done that way. On top of a lot of other things, like being the first record I'd ever done without the counterbalance of Jay Farrar's lyrics and voice, I hear him in the negative space of that record, you know, like it. So, but more than anything, it was just like a continuation. It was done so quickly after Uncle Tupelo had broken up, and then so by the time we made Being There, I had reassessed all of that. I'd had time to, and I'd had time to say to myself, "That's not very fun," you know. That's like ruling out all of these sounds and all of these things on records that I've loved so much for so long, like Beatles records and weirder records than that that my brother gave me, like, you know, Amandul records and Kraftwerk and things that were really, I had an early kind of weird connection with some of this wild art rock that was completely pushed outside of, what we could draw on in Uncle Tupelo. But it was just a realization that that stuff can be included.
Yeah. Around that time, sort of as you did with Jay Farrar in the book, you talk about another important Jay in your musical life, really lovingly, who became a part of your musical life around the time of Being There, and that's Jay Bennett. And you talk about what happened when he came on board and you started playing music together, and that you knew he was a really great guitar player. But then what else did you find out about him along the way?
Well, he was a great guitar player in a way that I found hard. When he joined the band, we had made AM and we were starting to play those songs live. And he could obviously do really great guitar parts on all these songs. But his level of virtuosity really felt alien to me. I was really having a tough time picturing how that sits next to my squeaky, unsure voice. You know, like there was a weird sensation that it was going to there was an authority to his guitar playing that was going to undermine my insecurities. That what I was like being trying to be open about, or you know, like that I was trying to have fragility to the music, and when somebody's like shredding, it just sounds like, well, this guy doesn't seem like he's very sure of himself, but that guy's shredding, you know. That's the best way I can describe it. I don't know. It was a lot more intuitive than this at the time. It wasn't really thought out. It was just more like, this is... anyway, so when I saw him play the keyboards for the first time, I didn't realize he could play the keyboards. He matched my voice a lot better on the keyboards because he was a little less sure of himself. And so it became a lot more symbiotic in the way we could work together on songs because everything sounded like it was coming from the same universe.
Anybody who's seen the Sam Jones documentary that you bring up in this book about Wilco at that time and making Yankee Hotel Foxtrot and the tension between you and Jay Bennett sort of, I think, thinks that they know that part of the story or that part of your relationship. But the way that you describe it in the book, you sort of get to a point later on where Jay needs to not be in the band anymore, and it's a mortal need for him not to be in the band anymore for you. Can you explain why you both couldn't survive in Wilco at the same time?
Well, I try my best in the book, and I don't know if I can do a better job in a short question or answer right now. But there was a part of me that might not have recognized it at the time, but we were both struggling with the same types of problems with addiction. I was in a period where I was actually convinced that I was going to be okay because I had managed to quit taking drugs by myself. I hadn't really gone through it. I hadn't done any work to feel like I was going to be better. But like any addict will tell you, quitting isn't the problem. Not starting again is the problem. I knew it was going to be hard staying around somebody who was in deep denial about his own problems. So that was a part of it. But it wasn't the biggest part of it, I don't think, to me at the time. The biggest part was that that I really liked having an atmosphere, a group that felt all for one, one for all, kind of like there's a real, you know, collective spirit to what we were doing, and it had become impossible for that to happen because of the different dynamics and the way Jay's own insecurities inhibited his interactions with other members in the band, I think. You know, he was, like, really good at diminishing other people's works. At the same time, he was obviously making beautiful contributions to the record, but it was a very complicated thing. So having said all that, it wasn't my decision alone. It's portrayed that way in the movie, but I wouldn't have never asked Jay to leave the band if it wasn't something that Leroy and John and Glenn, who had just joined the band, all really understood to be what needed to happen.
Yeah. You, in talking about your own use of opioids, you talk about somebody that you referenced earlier sort of in jest, but this guy who would, like, give you triple what you were being prescribed of Vicodin, and you talk about this therapist who discouraged you from taking antidepressants because he felt like it would be bad for your creativity. And as I was reading those passages, like, I was furious. I was, like, sitting in my apartment, like, steaming that people could see somebody going through what you were going through and partake in it. So how was it for you writing about that? Were you, like, what did you feel writing those stories?
Well, for my former therapist from years and years ago, there's anytime that he comes up in our family, there's anger because he was criminal. It was a criminal. It's criminally negligent to tell somebody that opioids are good for them and that they should stop taking their antidepressants, you know, which is what he basically told me. And I can beat myself up a lot for feeling like, why would I take such horrible advice? Well, when you're a drug addict, that's music to your ears, you know? That's the greatest thing anybody could ever tell you. And I knew I needed help, so I was reaching out to somebody that was had a certificate on his wall that I was assuming is there to help me. So I have to let myself off the hook a little bit for that, but yeah, it's really terrible. He did a really terrible thing, and the kid is a lot harder to castigate or something. You know, I think he was a fan, and he just thought he was helping me out, you know, like he didn't realize, I don't think he recognized the danger.
Yeah. We were talking at the start about these conversations that you put in the book that you've had with your wife, Susie, and with your son. And one of the conversations that you relay with Susie in the part of the book that we're talking about right now starts with her saying, "I still can't believe you're including the part about stealing my mom's cancer medication." Mm-hmm. And you write, "I barely remember that, and I wish I didn't remember it at all." Mm-hmm. So not only do you remember that, but you've committed it to a book as an author. Why did you want to put that in your book?
I think it's pretty hard to do better without remembering yourself at your worst. I can't change the past. I can't change the things that have happened. And being dishonest about them or not acknowledging them, I don't see how that helps me stay healthy. I think you're only as healthy as your secrets. And I don't really know if that's a secret I needed to share with all of you. But I do think it's something I need to keep more front and center in my mind than I would need to if I wasn't an addict, you know, because that's a horrible memory, and it's a useful kind of pain to have that memory, because I can go to that pretty quickly from having a temptation of. You know, I'm not around a lot of pharmaceuticals these days, but there are temptations from time to time. And when you remember something as devastatingly awful as that, it's a pretty good, way to change your mind.
Yeah. I guess I want to close out on this idea because we're running tight on time, and I was going to have you read the passage from the book, but I think we can just talk about it. One of the stories that you relay from being in rehab, which was like a pretty rough and tumble sort of a rehab, it sounds like, and rough around the edges, you relay the story of sort of feeling hesitant, I guess, to share why you're there, because you feel like what you've been through doesn't measure up to these experiences that other people are relaying of their own pain. And, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody shares a story of watching their father murder their mother, and people are dealing with, like, you literally write about these things in the book, and that you're thinking, like, what am I going to say? I have headaches and I get sad sometimes. Like, and you say it with such honesty. And then you have a moment with a guy there who basically knocks some sense into you. And I think it's really important to say for you to say what he said, because we're living in times where there's a lot of pain running around, and it's a big moment of empathy. So do you want to say what happened, or do you want to read the passage from the book? Or?
I could just paraphrase. Yeah. I think that what he was, I was apologizing to him. We were in group therapy together, and he had shared a horrifying story of his childhood. He was given alcohol. I don't know if I included all of this in the book, but the first alcohol he ever drank in his life was when he was 9 years old. His father had given it to him because he was under the impression that if he got his son drunk right away, he would never remember that he had just witnessed him shooting his mother. And this was a story that was told going around a group therapy group. And I'm sitting there thinking, it's going to get to me, and I'm going to say I get sad sometimes just because I'm not sure. You know, like I was evaluating my suffering as if I was supposed to be winning pain or something. You know, I'm going to be I'm going to out pain something. I don't know. It was just a really fucked up way of looking at things. And he called me out on it because I apologized. I don't even know if I belong in here because... I've never had anything that traumatic happen to me in my life, and he said that doesn't help anybody, you know, for you to weigh your pain against mine. It's like, just be here for me and I'll be here for you, and we all suffer relatively to each other. I'm not going to deny you hurting, because it's not the same, but it's about as profound of a, you know, ideas anybody had ever presented to me in my life.
Thank you for writing it in a book. Guys, Jeff Tweedy.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's an incredibly empathetic thing to put into the world, and I personally thank you for putting that thought out in the world, into the literary world.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. I think we have some questions from the audience that we're going to get to, if you're okay with it. I know.
I noticed some people came in later. You guys, was your car in a ditch or anything? No, I'm not saying that's the only reason you could have been late. But the weather was pretty bad. You're okay? Okay.
We're glad you're here.
Yeah. Sorry. I don't know. That's been eating at me the whole time.
Has it really? I'm sorry. It's like,
the nerve of these people. Coming late to my book event. No, that's not it. Honestly, it was more about, because somebody tweeted something about a car in a ditch coming to this event, and I was just like, I felt terrible. What a terrible way to die. On your way to see a book event. Jeez. That would just be the worst. You're all okay, though. You all made it. And I'm assuming that the people that were in more danger stayed home. Okay. Go ahead. What's that? Yeah.
Well.
I hope not.
That's what. I hope they were listening to, you know.
Then I don't care as much. I'm like, that. They drive off the road, that's on them.
Oh, that's really funny. Okay, so here's a first question that we got from the crowd. Oh, I like this one. What was it like to work with Mavis Staples, who you've been doing a whole bunch of work with over the last?
Well, I won't answer that. Uh-oh.
Ooh.
I won't answer that question in the past tense.
What is it like?
I still am able to work with her in the future. And the quickest, easiest answer about Mavis is always whatever you picture an angel being, whatever an angel's effect on a room would be, I think that's what effect she has. Everyone around her feels better about themselves, I don't know. She has the magical ability to make everyone feel better.
Yeah. That's lovely. We have a high school English teacher in the house. So as a high school English teacher, I have to ask, what kind of student were you, and did you have any favorite books as a teenager? We're in the library, so this feels like a good question.
I was a terrible student. My sister is a teacher. And one of her prized possessions is one of my report cards that has me flunking out of creative writing. And she teaches special needs children, and she actually thinks, she uses it as an example of how wrong. That's really sweet of her, but she uses it as like how wrong certain kids can be evaluated when you're using like grade systems and so yeah. And as far as favorite books as a teenager, I think I was trying to be as edgy as possible. So my books were probably favorite books were like Henry Miller and Burroughs and stuff like that, which I don't understand at all.
I don't know if you're supposed to. Okay, this is a wacky, wild. I think we have just time for one or two more questions. One more question. This is it. This is a wacky wild card one, but here we go. Ready?
Okay.
Somebody has noticed that unlike most rock bands, Wilco rarely or never sings about sex. Is there a reason for that? FYI, I dig that you find so much else to write about.
How do you know we don't sing about sex? Is my first answer. Maybe your idea of sex is so narrow that it doesn't include muzzles of bees, hummingbirds.
Uh,
There's enough stuff about sex in the world, as far as I'm concerned. You know, sex is just so fucking overrated, right? I mean, it's pretty easy. It's really easy. Like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the two other parts of it, sex and drugs, you don't need to have any skills to do either one of those things. Rock and roll requires commitment. I don't know.
Amen.
You know what? I'm going to just make a mental note right now to not have my wife be directly in the line of what I'm looking at when I do these in the future. I want to tell the event organizers that when I write my next book, which I forgot the title of already.
Oh, we already forgot it. That was it. Turds in the fishbowl.
Turds in a punch bowl.
Open the punch bowl.
Turds in a punch in a fishbowl. That's disgusting.
Did you say punch?
Punch bowl. No, my next book is Leave Them Wanting Less, My Guide to Show Business.
Well, on that note, would you maybe be so kind as to play us a couple of tunes that are or are not about sex? Everybody can just,
okay,
you know.
I will be happy to.
Would you? Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. Guys, Jeff Tweedy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Talia. Uh-oh. Thank you, Eric. That's Eric, everybody. Eric, do you have a capo? I think I forgot my capo. Which would really help for the next song I was gonna play. But capo. It's not Eric's fault. It's my fault. That he's gonna have to clean it up. Thank you, Eric. This is a song about sex. Could be. His goal in life was to be an echo, riding alone town after town, toll after toll, thick span out through the great southwest to forget her. She appears in his dreams, but in his car and in his arms, a dream can mean anything. A cheap sunset on a television set could upset her, but he never could remember to remember me, standing still in your past, floating fast like a hummingbird. His goal in life was to be an echo, the type of sound that floats around and then back down like a feather. But in the deep chrome canyons of the loudest Manhattans, no one could hear him or anything. So he slept on a mountain, in a sleeping bag underneath the stars, he'd lie awake and count them. And the great fountain spray, the great Milky Way would never let him die alone. Remember to remember me, standing still in your past, floating fast like a hummingbird. Remember to remember me, standing still in your past, floating fast like a hummingbird. Song from the record that I have coming out at the end of the month. So.
Don't let it kill you. Don't forget, I won't forget the long drive. We arrived in time to say goodbye. And the way my roses shook, I won't overlook the willows bending by the graves. The very next day in the shade, sweating in a new suit, I don't regret sometimes. We all think about dying. Don't let it kill you.
Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Talia.
Get home safe, everybody. Thank you all for coming. Jeff Tweedy.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.